Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, one Arizona traffic school teacher on what's behind the rise in road rage.
And looking back on recordings that changed the face of jazz.
But first, the Scottsdale City Council has approved a development plan for Axon. The taser maker wants to build a new headquarters in North Scottsdale, but the project would also include housing, a hotel, and restaurants. It's been controversial, with some residents expressing concern about traffic and density, among other worries. With me to talk about the project and the opposition to it is Karina Vanek of the Arizona Republic. Karina, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So what exactly does this development plan entail?
So you did a good job summing it up. It includes Axon's world headquarters, as well as the more controversial part, which is about 1,900 apartments, about 425 hotel rooms, and 7 restaurants. The real crux of the controversy was those apartments.
Why does Axon want all of that other stuff right next to its headquarters?
Good question. So when I spoke with the CEO, Rick Smith, he pointed to a lot of other companies and cities around the country about wanting to have kind of synergy around their campuses, giving their employees options to live near where they work, giving people a place to stay. If they come to Axon for a conference or for a meeting, they can stay close to the campus. They don't have to get an Uber, and places for employees to eat before, after, or during lunch, so that they can easily walk to.
Okay, so this plan, as I mentioned, was controversial, and it was even more controversial before some changes made, right? Like, what did Axon originally want to do, and how has that been kind of scaled back?
Exactly. So the major scale back came on the apartment side. There were at first about 2,400 apartments proposed in there, but that does account for a change that was made. Now it's about 1,900, but there is another 365 units that will be for sale condos. So the unit count didn't drop completely that much. There was a change to be some of these units to be for sale instead of for rent.
But it seems like, at least for some residents, the changes didn't really placate them, right? Like, it sounds like there was still a decent amount of anger and frustration and consternation when the city council approved this.
There absolutely was. And for some residents, they did acknowledge they liked the changes, they appreciated some effort, but that it really didn't get to what they had been asking for. And the major thing that they had been asking for was a very large reduction in density. When I spoke to the HOA president for the HOA that's next to the site, she was asking for 500 apartments compared to almost 2,000 that they're actually proposing.
Yeah, that's a really big difference of opinion there.
Yes. And so it's safe to say that even with the change to the plan, there wasn't a meeting of the minds there.
Okay, so one of the other things that some residents were complaining about is the fact that this was approved when it was, meaning that it's just a couple of months before a new city council will be taking office, one that presumably will be maybe less enthusiastic about projects like this. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, definitely a fair assessment. And I think it's really telling that you do have a future council member who is going to take her seat in January speaking at the meeting, saying that residents had talked to her asking her how she could stop apartments when she doesn't get a vote in something like this, which comes right before her term will begin.
What do residents say? Maybe they didn't say much to you about this, but I'm curious what, you know, obviously the Valley has a shortage of housing. What did residents say about how they think Scottsdale can build new places for people to live when they have concerns about apartments, they have concerns about density, that kind of thing?
They have a lot of concerns about density in apartments. And I would say generally, and trying not to paint with a broad brush, but there is a very anti-apartment sentiment. You can see that in the election results for the Scottsdale City Council. Like I said, the the HOA president of the neighboring HOA did say they could deal with some apartments, just about a quarter of the amount proposed. So I think that maybe there is some acknowledgement that we could find a place with, you know, lower density. There could be some kind of happy medium there, but certainly not to the degree that's been proposed here.
Okay. So what is the timeline now? Like, when will ground be broken? When might all this stuff be built?
So obviously with the approval yesterday, they're okay to start moving ahead with some things. They have agreed to a phasing plan that will start with the Axon World headquarters, the actual commercial building where Axon will be based. Mm-hmm. And that first phase will also include the hotel and about 230 of the apartment units. The second phase, which would begin in 2027, would be the condo units and another 260 apartment units. And then there'd be two more phases in 2028 and 2029 to bring about the remaining apartment units and those restaurants.
Is it possible that, given the new city council, that some of those later phases might be adjusted or not happen?
Adjusted could be possible. The zoning decision made by a council is a legal agreement. So without a major, major change in something that Axon is proposing, it wouldn't be very possible for a council to go back and reverse a decision by a mm-hmm. previous council. There is a legal sentiment to that. But it's common for these proposals that happen in phases to have to go back through like a design review process or the permitting process with the city. So it's possible then that there could be some tweaks or some asks that happen throughout those years as things progress and change that could maybe not significantly change the project, but they could change it, particularly on a design or a scheduling look.
All right. We'll see what happens. That is Karina Vanek of the Arizona Republic. Karina, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Let's turn now to a conversation about our state's water future and how it intersects with ongoing demands to build housing in the Valley. Last summer, Governor Katie Hobbs restricted new building in Metro Phoenix that would solely rely on groundwater. The move came after new projections from the Arizona Department of Water Resources showed demand would outpace groundwater resources over the next 100 years by about 4%. She said at the time that it didn't mean we're running out of water in Arizona, but that we're taking a necessary step toward sustainability. But since, developers have been advocating for options so they can keep building in fast-growing parts of the valley like Buckeye and Queen Creek, which are most affected by Hobbs' plan. And the Department of Water Resources is pushing for a rule change to put the governor's plan into effect. But opponents say it's illegal. And of course, politics are involved here. So here to explain it all is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from our politics desk. Hey there, Cameron.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Water, your favorite topic. So let's get into it. Tell us first, what is this proposed rule change from ADWR?
It is my favorite topic. Okay, so basically, in a nutshell, the governor's office said just about a year ago, we are not in a place where we have enough groundwater for us to keep building like we have been mm-hmm. in the Phoenix area, because we have a lot of people and it's a really populated area, but the groundwater supplies are low. So we don't want development to be built just on groundwater. So basically everybody else, who includes the home builders, developers, EPCOR, utilities, they're all like, well, okay, that's well and good, but we need to keep building.
Yeah.
So that started this whole process of what are we going to do to come up with a plan so that we can still develop and also not run out of water immediately. So ADWR, which is the Executive Water Agency, the Arizona Department of Water Resources, they came up with some recommendations, and that's what we're considering now. So in a nutshell, like I said, because I don't want to get into too many details, it's you can still develop, but you have to find some sort of alternative water supply. So
sure.
It's not just groundwater, even though you can also still use groundwater. And then the idea is that you wean yourself off of groundwater dependence and you sort of offset the cost.
Isn't the idea about groundwater, Cameron, that it's our kind of backup? It's like what we use when we do and if we ever do run out of water?
That would be great, but we're using it for a lot of things, and we're using it far too much, and it's going down faster than we're replenishing it.
Sure. Okay, so you've got ADWR kind of trying to put the governor's plan into place with this new proposed rule change that you described there. But as we said, people are not happy about this. What do its opponents have to say?
Well, I spoke mostly with Spencer Camps, and he is with the Home Builders Association, and he is opposing it not because he doesn't want to be able to develop and have an alternative to the groundwater system that we've been using, mm-hmm. but because he and several of the other stakeholders in this process don't like the way that ADWR has pitched their plan. So they're saying it would basically be too expensive, and that's their main concern. And he's saying that we should base this off of how much groundwater and how much water different kinds of building use. So like residential building, for example, which is what the home builders do, that doesn't use that much groundwater as opposed to commercial or industrial, for example. So he's saying, well, it's not really fair that we have to spend all this extra money and stuff, even though we're not really the problem.
Interesting. Okay. And he's also saying that this will be expensive, but not just expensive for them, but expensive for homeowners. Those costs he thinks will get passed down.
Right. He said the cost gets passed on to whoever's buying their houses, and that it could be upwards of, you know, tens of thousands of dollars onto the price of the home.
But so what would developers like to see happen then instead?
Well, for themselves, I assume they would want some sort of sweet package that's targeted towards home builders in particular that says, oh, you guys are great. You know, you don't have to pay too much more money, or you don't have to change what you're doing too much. Mm-hmm. And they want it to be more focused on other types of building, I would assume.
Okay. Then you have politics that are, of course, going to get involved in this. We have Senator T.J. Shope, who was recently appointed to chair the Senate Natural Resources Committee. This deals with water issues. He's new to this committee. What might he do?
Right. So the politics angle is a lot of different things because there are so many people involved in this. It's not just the governor and it's not just her water agency. There's also another group, which is the governor's regulatory review council, who has to rule on the changes that ADWR wants to make. Plus, there's everybody who's not a political office giving their two cents and getting involved, like Spencer Camps. Shope's angle in this, he is with the GOP lawmakers. And so the state legislature is majority Republican lawmakers. And he just got this important new appointment, which is to lead the Natural Resources Committee in the state Senate. And basically that means that any water bills are going to go through his committee. And he made a point of saying, and so did the Senate president in this press release, that they are going to be focused on housing stuff this year. Housing and water have this complicated relationship because Arizona is a state that needs a lot more water than we have. And we're also a state that needs more housing.
Yeah.
But you can't have one without the other. And you can't have people living without water and housing. And it's messy.
It's messy. Okay, so we will see what happens on the political front. What's the next step here, Cameron, in terms of the plan from the governor?
Okay, so the Regulatory Review Council is scheduled to meet at the beginning of December, and they're going to vote on whether to approve this proposal that ADWR has put forward, because it's rule changes and the GRC, which is what's called the GRC. The GRC has to approve all those rule changes, but we're going to see if they actually agree to do that or not.
Okay, and lots of public comment in the meantime, it sounds like?
Public comment in the meantime, and people basically accusing the governor of being anti-growth while she accuses them of not, you know, respecting that we don't have enough water to just keep going and building willy-nilly.
Sounds like a fight that will not end anytime soon.
Nope.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez joining us from our politics desk. Cameron, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, when Miles Davis and his band first recorded what would eventually become Birth of the Cool, many people thought it was too avant-garde. But then it was released as an album years later.
And it became known as a landmark album that sort of changed the sound of jazz, this cool sound, which is why it was obviously called Birth of the Cool.
A local trumpet player explains the album's significance.
But first, an executive at Amazon says if employees don't like the retail giant's new return-to-office policy, they can leave their jobs. Amazon has been having its employees in the office 3 days a week, but recently announced it was upping that to 5 days a week. And that's led to speculation that other companies might follow suit and require their workers to spend more time in the office. All of this, of course, follows the trend since the pandemic of many employees either working from home or a hybrid setup of spending some time at home and some time in the office. And this could have implications for the commercial real estate market. As firms had fewer workers in the office, they needed less office space. But if those employees are coming back, how will those businesses respond? With me to talk about this is Trevor Pratt, a managing director at the commercial real estate firm JLL here in Phoenix. And Trevor, what are you seeing in terms of companies in the Valley trying to get workers back in the office? Is that a thing that's happening here?
It is. And I'm seeing more and more of that over, I'd say, the last 6 months, especially with some of the big names, the Amazons and the Dells of the world, coming out and doing that. It seems to be a bit of a domino effect here for Phoenix.
How much of that do you attribute to a company, for example, like Amazon doing this, other companies saying, well, if Amazon's doing it, maybe we should too?
I think, frankly, a lot of it. And a lot of it, I think, is it's giving these companies the confidence to do it because, you know, somebody else is the first to break the trend. And as the job market gets tighter, I feel that organizations are getting more comfortable saying, hey, we want you back in some capacity.
So what kinds of trends are you seeing in terms of workers maybe coming back full time, a few days a week, and you know, maybe companies trying to figure out what kind of office space they need to accommodate that? Or maybe they're having workers come back in a way that will make it so that the space they have works for the amount of folks that they would have in the office at any given time.
I would say that the trend is anywhere from 3 to 5 days a week. And each organization is different, and they need to find that sweet spot for what works for not only their employees and their model, but also their real estate. And we're in a pretty early process, I would say, of these organizations figuring out what the long-term real estate strategy is for this return to work. And the overarching trend, I would say, for nearly all organizations is how can we make our real estate attractive to employees so that they want to come back or don't fight coming back?
So in terms of space, it's maybe more quality over quantity?
100%.
Well, especially, you know, as people started coming back to work after the worst of COVID, we heard so much about some number of companies anyway, downsizing, and as you say, maybe focusing on more collaborative spaces. You know, they don't need a couple of floors in a building, maybe just one, and, you know, sort of reconfiguring their space. Do you find that that is impacting how they are trying to go about getting workers back to the office?
I do. I think we're seeing that. I'm not hearing nearly as many of the, oh, this company's downsizing, this company's downsizing. It's a lot of either companies are feeling comfortable with the reduced footprint that they took, or they're needing room for growth. And again, I think that goes back to, hey, what is their occupancy strategy? And, you know, in particular, do you go with what we call hot desking, which is, you know, you just come in and you hotel for a day at an office, mm-hmm. or does each employee have their own workstation? And it's funny, you know, employees start to feel like their workstation is their second home. So people, you know, tend to gravitate towards that. And I would say what I'm seeing right away is that companies, there's more that are looking to grow than reduce at this footprint, which is a really promising sign for our industry.
Is that a departure from what you've seen over the past number of years?
Definitely.
Well, so given, as you say, it's been a little bit of a roller coaster over the last several years, what is all this doing to the commercial real estate market in the Valley?
You know, a roller coaster, I think, is a polite way of putting it. It keeps you on your toes, that's for sure. You know, there was obviously the pandemic and how that affected everybody's occupancy strategy. You've got the capital markets and interest rates that have played some games with all of us. And now, you know, I would say over the last couple of years, we were trying to spin a positive message to, you know, to the audience. And now it feels like we're really going on a positive trend of, more than anything, companies and individuals having confidence in their decision. And whether that's we're going to have people work fully from home or we're going to have people in the office 5 days a week, there doesn't seem to be this uncertainty at this point. It's almost feels like the trial, they've had a long enough period to figure out what works for their organization, and more organizations are finding that for the most productive employees and happiest employees for their organization, it's being in the office in some form.
Well, so what is the state right now of available supply in Phoenix? Because as we've talked about, for a while, companies were trying to downsize, and now all of a sudden, it seems like they need more space. Are you finding that companies are looking to take space that is already available, that's already up? Are you expecting more building in the near term?
So I would say that I don't foresee any new construction. We call it speculative construction. Mm-hmm. Until, gosh, a couple of years at the earliest, in my opinion. And I think that's a combination of interest rate driven, but also when you look at our market, we're at a total vacancy right now of 25%. A really healthy market for us, in my opinion, is closer to 15 to 17.
Wow.
Now, we also got to remember that Phoenix, as a metropolitan city, we're always going to have some level of vacancy because of the land and the ability to build. And what we need to focus on is what's leasing right now is the highly amenitized, high-end, attractive space. And we have parts of our market where it's outdated space, and we have to figure out, what do we do with this space? Can we turn it into a different type of use, or do we need to invest money into it to make it attractive to organizations? And so, again, I think we're always going to have a healthy amount of vacancy. We are a little ways off from new development, in my opinion, but we're going to see more landlords investing money into their projects to bring them up to the quality of the space that's leasing.
How does what you're seeing in Phoenix compare to what, maybe some of your colleagues are seeing in other parts of the country?
The Sun Belt states, I think we've been a bigger benefit over the last couple of years of we have had companies that felt more comfortable being in the office and having employees return to the office. When you look at some of the counterparts of ours, the San Francisco's, the New York's, the Seattle's of the world, they have been slower to respond and be back in the office, in my opinion. And they are trending in the right direction. But we, again, I think have been in the benefit of a little bit of a quicker push back to the office.
All right. That is Trevor Pratt, a managing director at JLL here in Phoenix. Trevor, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Appreciate your time.
Road rage incidents have been going up across the country since the COVID-19 pandemic, and they can get serious fast. More often now, they involve guns. Here in Arizona, the Arizona Department of Transportation reports in 2023, nearly 1,000 crashes were categorized as road rage. 7 of them were fatal, 9 people died, more than 300 were injured. And our next guest says a whole lot more of them could have been based on the cases she sees every day. Kim Rogers has taught driving school classes in Arizona for about a decade. 3 years ago, she started her own school, AZKAR Traffic School, an official traffic survival school licensed by the Motor Vehicle Division. She teaches 8-hour courses for people who have committed serious violations, from DUIs to aggressive driving to drag racing and road rage. And she told me she's seen the rise in road rage in recent years. I spoke with her more about it, beginning with how often she sees drivers with road rage-related cases in her classroom.
Well, more often than not, I'm sorry to say, because as you get to know the person, and obviously I've got time on my hands within an 8-hour class day,
yeah,
to get and dig deeper as to what brought them in here and to have them look at their actions behind the actual violation that they received, then it gives me the opportunity to say, what was going on in your life at that time? What was going on in your head? Where were you that day? Mm. And then as they start telling their stories, the more that they feel comfortable with the setting, with me, and seeing where this class is going to go, you'd be surprised at the stories you do learn.
What about when it comes to explicitly road rage kinds of cases? What are the stories you hear?
Well, it's going to be a very sad story because something's triggered it. You know, something going on in their world that they don't feel was justified or right, or that they were wronged somehow, someplace. And it can be the innocence of things. Another driver could have really upset them by coming onto the freeway. Maybe they cut them off. Mm-hmm. Maybe they flipped them off. You know, you never know what's going to trigger somebody's anger at that point, because all these other factors. And when that one thing happens, regardless of how small we think it is, if we're the ones doing it, that's enough to make them just blow. And then that's when you see them coming into these classes, because they have a whole list of things that the courts have ordered them to do, and I'm one piece of it.
So, I mean, like, how do you reach folks like that? Like, how do you teach them to control their anger on the road? How do you get at the kind of why behind it? You're not a psychologist, right? Like, this isn't, you're not a counselor.
No, I'm not.
Right.
I think it's probably because the way the course material is worked, a lot of the information and the message that is given to these students, for example, if it's a DUI, they've got to go through drug and alcohol screening, perhaps MAD classes. These are all geared around psychology, anger management. Mm-hmm. They're going to be seeing a counselor. So these classes, in fact, our workbooks is based on a book that was written by Dr. William Glasser called The Choice Theory. So he too was a counselor. So they all try to make it somewhat an agreement of what the overall goal is of that, what the message we're trying to deliver.
It's interesting because it's so rehabilitative, I guess, is the word that comes to mind.
And that's the idea.
It's not punitive.
No, and that's at least not the environment I want my students in. You know, I'm not sitting there in judgment and jury.
Have you noticed trends over the years in the kinds of cases you see in these classes since you've taught this for so long? I mean, we've seen rates of road rage go up around the country and here in Arizona at points as well.
Well, I have seen that as well. And it's sad to me because it's like, why? You know, there are times where I get youthful drivers into the room and they've gotten their violations, and you get to talking to them, and what I'm left with is the fact that they've never had any formal training behind the wheel. They have no idea what the rules of the roads are. And so it's like starting from ground zero. And that to me is a tragedy, because what are we doing to them? And what are we doing to the rest of the world that we're driving in? And no wonder there's people that are angry, because they don't know how to interpret what's going out there, or they're not interpreting wisely what's going out there. You know, we were always told as a kid, you know, growing up, learning how to drive, getting your independence, you think of driving as an extension of just common courtesy. And people don't regard it that way. It's, I'm sorry to say that, but and that's a huge generalization on part, but that's what it boils down to.
So if you're talking about the change you've seen, right, like in people kind of disregarding these common courtesy kinds of based laws, which it's interesting that they are sort of just based in common courtesy.
They are.
Do you worry that we've lost that sense of common courtesy in this culture today?
I do. I mean, what do we hear all the time? I don't care what the subject material is. It's like we've forgotten that we're one another. We're human, you know, and that we have feelings, and that, you know, what impacts you might impact me too somewhere. It might be a rippling effect, but we're all in this together. And unfortunately, we've lost sight of that.
So that's pointing at a much larger problem. I'm sure that's kind of bigger than you can deal with in a class.
I wish I could, but I'm not qualified.
Right. But I wonder this a lot when you see people mad on the road, or see people kind of driving super aggressively on the road. Like, is there a sense that you think people get when they're behind the wheel of a car and their windows are up and you can't really see who's driving the other cars, that it's like they disconnect it from the fact that these are other human beings driving?
Absolutely. They don't care. They've shut that part of their brain off or whatever. I could give you an example. There was a study done where, for example, we're driving on a surface street road and you see drivers that will zigzag out of lanes, which is aggressive driving maneuver, only for you to meet them at the same red light that you're coming up on. So they asked, okay, why do drivers do this? So that was their study. Well, the drivers would say, you know, I'm running late. I can't I'll be late for my work. Otherwise, I'll get fired. This is why I'm doing it. Okay, so then the question became, well, are they saving a lot of time by doing this?
Right.
Do you know how much time they're actually saving? 7 to 8 seconds. So you do the cost-benefit analysis. Is it worth somebody's life? Is it worth your car being damaged? Whatever.
Yeah.
Is it worth that over 7 to 8 seconds?
Do guns play a role in this often?
Often. You know, it's like I tell people, you don't know who's going to pull up beside you. You might get upset with them. You want to flip them off. You want to give them some obscene gesture.
Mm.
Or you cut in front of them because they're not going fast enough for you, or whatever the circumstances are. How do you know what they've got in their car? They don't know you. And I've had students tell me, yeah, I was an aggressive driver and I did this and I saw them pull out a gun and I got out of there. And I'm like,
yeah. What's your advice to other drivers on the road in terms of, based on all the things that you've seen and heard from folks who come through your classes, how should we all kind of treat each other driving on the roads?
Step back, take a moment, take a breath, whatever it takes. Yeah, our first reaction might be to get really upset. But if we just step back, I mean, what's it going to hurt if somebody has got in their heads that they're going to go and be ahead of me? If I just hang back a little bit, what are we talking about? A second or two, if that?
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, by doing and having that more relaxed approach, you'd be amazed at how more relaxed you are.
All right, that is Kim Rogers, owner and instructor at AZKAR Traffic School, talking to us about the folks she sees come through the increase in road rage. Kim, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. One of the Valley's racing legends recently made history. The show's Sam Dingman has the story.
When Kim Hayashi was a kid, her dad took her to visit the offices of the American Bicycle Association in Gilbert. She remembers walking down the hallways, looking up at framed photos of members of the BMX Hall of Fame.
And you're like, wow, that's really cool. Like,
right. They're
legends. Like, these guys are icons. And as a 12-year-old, you just never think that maybe one day you would end up on the wall with all these really, really great people.
But earlier this year, in September, that's exactly what happened.
So please join us in giving a rousing round of applause as we welcome your 2024 Women's BMX Hall of Fame inductee, Kim Hayashi.
Hayashi's Hall of Fame credentials are undeniable. In the early 2000s, she won 5 straight National Bicycle League titles and won the junior women's division at the Union of International Cyclists World Championship. That's just a tiny fraction of her resume. But even as she was walking up to the Hall of Fame podium, Hayashi found herself in disbelief. She'd never really stopped to think about how unlikely her story is.
I probably didn't even fall in love with BMX the first time that I rode. Being 12, I was much older than a lot of kids who started racing, because even my brother started racing at 8.
Hayashi's brother is actually the reason she started riding. The family was spending the majority of their weekends at the BMX track.
And my mom just really came to me one day and said, we're going to do this as a family, so you're going to participate. And I said, I'm good. And she said, no. You're going to, I'm forcing you to do this.
Hayashi's reluctance faded pretty quickly.
I raced my first race against a bunch of boys, and I won. And that sort of competitiveness in me just really wanted to continue. Because what other sport, like, I'd never really played any other sports where I was beating boys.
Huh.
So I think that's what really got me hooked.
Hayashi kept racing, and she kept winning. She says she's always been small in stature, 4'11", to be exact. And BMX racing was the first sport she'd ever played where that was an advantage.
My dad and I sat down and figured, like, I can't go toe-to-toe with girls who are, 20, 30, 40 pounds heavier than me or a foot taller than me. So I think we really hunkered down on, hey, I, off the start, is, like, really where I had to be successful. And
okay.
So I really focused on just that and being short in stature and being as stocky as I am, that sort of powerfulness is really where I excelled.
Prior to this, Hayashi says she had viewed her body as a bit of an obstacle. Going into middle school, she'd gained a bunch of weight, and she kept hoping that she would get a growth spurt that would even things out. But the growth spurt never came.
It ended up being like a blessing in disguise because
it turned into muscle.
It turned into muscle, yeah. I very quickly was able, I couldn't even believe it. My dad bought us a squat rack for inside our garage, and we would be in there a couple times, you know, in the evening throughout the week, and we would stack on. It got to a point where I was like 16, and every single weight that we had in our garage, we put on the bar, and I was squatting it.
Before long, Hayashi had a nickname on the circuit, Lil' Kim. I watched some videos of her races on YouTube, and when she wins, it's not close. She seems to burst out of the gate, already moving at top speed.
Hayashi, Gabby, this is what the doctor ordered. Kim says, come on, follow me.
By the time the race hits the first turn, she's already several bike lengths ahead of everyone. But that doesn't mean that any of this was easy for Hayashi.
Before our main events or our finals, I would be literally throwing up my guts.
It wasn't that she doubted her skills. It was that she had trouble trusting that they would be there when she needed them.
So I was very analytical. So I was that person that oh man, I have to get out of the gate. I have to move over. I have to do this over the jumps. And I had practiced it. I already knew what I needed to do. And it made me overthink to the point where it would make me sick.
Hayashi's dad found a doctor who helped her come up with a healthier pre-race method than overthinking. She started listening to a series of tones on a set of headphones. Hayashi says it made her feel like the star of some Hollywood story about a baseball phenom.
You know, like in the movies, they slows down. You could see the laces. Mm-hmm. That's essentially how I felt.
Yeah.
When I was racing, it felt like it was in slow motion. I could feel myself going over the jumps, pushing my legs where I needed to, getting the backside that I needed to.
Wow. Meanwhile, everybody pressed up against the fence is watching you fly ahead.
Yeah.
In recent years, BMX Olympians like Brooke Crane and Elise Post have cited Hayashi as an inspiration, which means a lot to her. Hayashi herself never made it to the Olympics. In fact, she says it was Olympic training that ultimately made her decide to stop racing competitively. She was traveling all over the world almost every weekend, pushing herself past her physical limits. And early on, she'd made a deal with herself.
If there was a day I ever woke up and I didn't want to go ride my bike, I knew I was done.
When she woke up one day and didn't want to ride, Hayashi knew it was time to stop. But she didn't know what to do next. She went to college and graduated, but she felt lost. If she wasn't getting up every day to hit the gym and then the BMX track, she wasn't sure why she was getting up at all.
I went through this kind of phase of heavy depression. I don't talk about it a lot, but I think it's something that needs to be talked about and more athletes are talking about it. Because of that big high and immediately felt overnight, you just become this everyday person where you're not really training for a purpose. I left from traveling the world to delivering Domino's pizzas.
Hayashi knew she was walking a fine line. She'd seen fellow BMXers stop riding but keep chasing the high they used to get from winning races.
So they fall into either drug abuse, addiction, alcoholism, things of that nature.
Hayashi credits her family for keeping her focused on the future instead of trying to relive the past. She didn't love delivering Domino's pizza, but that job led to a gig at a wine bar, which led to an interview at Saki House in downtown Phoenix, where she's now a managing partner. That's where Hayashi decided she wanted to dedicate the rest of her life to hospitality. She loves everything about working at the restaurant, talking to guests, planning events, tinkering with the cocktail menu.
I don't think I've ever gotten up in the morning and said, I don't want to go to work.
I can't help noticing, though, that much like with BMX, you start working at Sake House and you instantly do the restaurant equivalent of racing to the front.
Yeah.
You got to find that high somewhere.
Yeah. all the characteristics that made you successful as a BMX racer are all things that you can use to make you successful in what I call the real world, right? Mm-hmm. Or in outside of BMX. I'm just out there competing because I want to win.
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
Good morning. It is The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. It has been 75 years since an all-star group of jazz musicians gathered to record a series of songs that some argue changed the face of the genre. But it took a little while for the album that would later become Birth of the Cool to make its real presence felt. In honor of the anniversary, trumpet player Louise Behringer has put together a band to play the songs from the album. They'll be performing tomorrow night at the Nash in Phoenix. Behringer joins me to talk more about this. And Louise, what appeals to you about these songs?
Well, this music has the most interesting sound. It was recorded in 1949 and 1950, and it was very avant-garde for its day. It was inspired by Gil Evans and his writing for the Claude Thornhill Orchestra, which was a big band in the 1940s, which included tuba and French horn. So Miles decided he wanted to do a smaller group version of this, and in conjunction with Jerry Mulligan and Lee Konitz and some of the other great players of the day, they were just kids then, they weren't famous then, they decided to do a nine-piece version rather than the big 15, 16-piece big band type version of music. And they wanted to do a nine-piece version of this music that had a jazz beboppy flavor, but still had one foot in the big band sound.
Yeah, what do you think the thinking was behind that? Because as you say, if you listen to these songs, you can hear big band sort of swing influences, but you can also hear that it's kind of moving away from that.
Well, these guys were trying to be very forward-thinking, and they were all students of impressionistic classical music, like Debussy, Ravel, Satie, those composers. And they were very intellectual thinkers, these musicians. And so they would get together and talk about how they could get those sort of impressionistic influences into music in 1949. And so they had a French horn in the band and a tuba, as well as saxophone, trombone, trumpet, and then a rhythm section. So it became this really unique sounding group that was sort of half bebop and half big band, but with an impressionistic sound.
And am I right that this never actually came out as an album?
Well, it did eventually, but in 1949, there were no albums, so it came out on 78 records. And the first recordings were released very sparsely. I think there were three records, which means six sides. Mm-hmm. And they ended up recording a total of 14 songs. So this music sort of was coolly received by the public. They were performing it live at the Royal Roost in New York, which is where Charlie Parker and Miles had been playing in 1947 and 48. So they released these sides. They weren't a big success. Everyone went on to do other things. And Pete Rugolo, who produced them around 1957, decided to release it as an album and call it Birth of the Cool. And it became a huge success. The music was never performed live again because all of those musicians had gone on to other things.
Big things.
In their career, big things. They all became famous and well-known. And if not, they were working in the studios making a good living. So the album was released and it became known as a landmark album that sort of changed the sound of jazz, this cool sound, which is why it was obviously called Birth of the Cool.
Yeah. How significant is it to you that the band you've put together for this performance is roughly split equally between men and women?
Well, I've always tried to hire, how can I say this? I hire my favorite players and I hire my friends as long as they're my favorite players. And being a woman in music, I have a lot of women friends in the music business. So I think that there aren't enough women in the music business. It's tough for women to be in the music business. There's still a lot of discrimination. You wouldn't believe what people come up with. What are you going to wear? You know, are you going to get along with the guys? I mean, it's amazing what people say, right? Even now. So I think that having a mixed band is an example of what the world should look like. What the music world should look like anyway. And, you know, I have a rehearsal. Nobody says anything about, oh, look at the women in the band. Everybody just plays. Either you can play or you can't.
Right.
That's what it boils down to in the music world.
It's so interesting because I think for a lot of people, you think of music as kind of like sports, the ultimate meritocracy. Like if you can play, you can do it regardless of who you are or what gender or race or ethnicity or anything you are. But it sounds like that's not necessarily the case.
Well, I've been really lucky. I mean, I've probably gotten as many gigs because I'm a woman as I've lost because I'm a woman. I've had some amazingly stupid things said to me by people, you know, because they don't know how to deal with having a woman in the band. I was kicked off a movie set because the star of the movie said, I don't want people looking at her. I want them looking at me.
Wow.
Yeah. I was actually sent home and they had to pay me anyway. So big deal. But I think the what it boils down to is when you're a man, they assume you can play unless you prove otherwise. When you're a woman, they assume you can't play until you prove otherwise. And I'm not saying that this is always the case, but it's often the case.
So let me ask you about some of your other work, because you have a couple of albums out, including one that is basically trumpet playing Motown music.
Right. Yeah. I decided that, well, my first album was sort of swing, big band. It was a great album. Arturo Sandoval, Carl Fontana, all these wonderful players played on it. Frank Sinatra Jr. sang a couple tunes. And it was really sort of big bandy swing type of music, a nine-piece band. Then I decided, what's popular right now? I mean, what's really, to an older audience that buys tickets, concert tickets, Motown. You know, big band music is sort of now sort of faded into the past, unfortunately. But that's what happens in music. It evolves. So I did an album, my friend Tim Ouimet, who's a wonderful arranger, used to write for Ray Charles. He wrote all the arrangements for me, and I recorded this in New York. And it's just all kind of Motown type of music. And it's really fun. It's, again, lots of horns. And it's just fun. People put it on and say they dance to it at home. And that's the biggest compliment I can get.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So if you are just sitting around listening to music, what are you going to listen to?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I don't listen to music as much as I should, probably.
Really?
When I was younger, I did a lot. But I like to listen to classical music a lot. I like to listen to Joshua Redman is my favorite saxophone player.
Yeah.
We just saw him at the MIM. He was amazing. But a mix of things, I think, whatever makes me feel good at that moment. I like all styles of music. Anything that's well done, I like to listen to.
Is there a type of music or maybe a particular piece that you have wanted to transcribe for trumpet or play on the trumpet that you haven't yet had a chance to?
Well, that's interesting. I always loved Ennio Morricone. And for years, I thought, I really want to play some of his music, you know, the great film composer, Italian film composer. And I think he's just the most wonderful composer. And Chris Botti beat me to it. I thought about it for too many years, and then he went and did it. But there's particularly some pieces from Cinema Paradiso, from The Mission that Chris has recorded beautifully, of course. Yeah, but every once in a while, I'll hear some piece of music, particularly film music. Growing up in L.A., I was really partial to that. My grandpa was in the film business, and I listened to some film music and say, I just really want to record that. And then I think, who's going to buy it? You know, I mean, I have to think about an audience, like, where do you play film music?
Yeah.
Right.
It's interesting because that kind of brings us back to the birth of the cool, right? Where Miles Davis and the other players were trying to sort of nudge the audience to something different, but didn't want to do it too much. And it's probably not too much of a stretch to say that they were thinking, if we go too far away from what people are listening to now and like, they might not listen to what we're doing.
I think that's true. I think those guys were building their careers, and they didn't want to lose their audience. They wanted to gain an audience. But at the same time, they wanted to express themselves in this new way. And so they had to kind of split the difference. And I'm sure they considered that.
All right, Louise, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Mark. I really appreciate it, too.
That is professional trumpet player Louise Berenger. The performance will be tomorrow night at the Nash in Phoenix.
All right, that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Mark will be back with you again tomorrow morning with your Friday newscap and much more. So be sure to join us then. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.